Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. I'm Karen, and today, as usual, I'm joined by my colleague, my friend, my roommate, Kristen!
Good morning. It's morning. I hate mornings.
I think I'm a little more chipper than you this morning.
Yes, that's, yeah.
I didn't used to be a morning person, and then that changed. I'm sorry. There's a look of betrayal in Kristen's eyes right now.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
Well, this'll pick up. We just gotta get going.
Nighttime is my friend. It's all right. It's all good.
That was in like a I am Batman voice.
My friend.
Okay. You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and at Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. One of these days we'll actually use Facebook.
Yeah.
Keep forgetting about it.
I'm still learning Instagram. God.
And Tumblr. I got to get on Tumblr.
I'm duh.
We'll get there.
We're old.
We are old. Okay. News and updates this week. We got a couple of things. It's not too crazy, but got some interesting stuff. The Goodreads Choice Awards for this year are out, and I'm not shocked, but it's amazing to see that four of the Rick Riordan Presents / Rick Riordan books are on the list. Best Middle Grade and Children's, you got Daughter of the Deep by Rick Riordan, Arusha and the City of Gold by Roshni Chokshi, The Last Fallen Star by Gracie Kim, and City of the Play God by Sarwat Chadha.
Congratulations! Woohoo!
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I will link to this. Opening round, it says, ends in 9 days, 15 hours, and 28 minutes. So by the time you guys listen to this, unless it's super far in the future, you will be able to vote in that. So that's exciting, and we'll see which ones get through and eventually win. I would not be super surprised if one of these won, but I'll be curious as to which one.
For sure.
Yeah. Kwame Mbalia has a newsletter called Black by Popular Demand, and I just have to tell you, perfection.
That is it some made me quality.
So happy. He's been doing this for a while. I think he's been doing this the entire year. I'm not sure if he did it before 2021, but basically he highlights the latest books from Black authors, and it's a newsletter you can sign up for. I'll put the link in the show notes, but that title alone, I'm just super into it.
Quality wordplay.
Yes.
We do love it.
We do. There's also an educator's guide for Tristan Strong Keeps Punching. So if we have any teacher friends who listen to us, I scrolled through it and it looks pretty cool, actually. So if you want to teach this book to your class, then there's some materials there that'll help you.
Also, that's awesome. I know, like, this isn't, like, a new thing, that really popular kids' books, especially, like, you know, middle grade and that, they have made themselves basically, like, teacher-friendly. Like, they found ways to do, you know, learning guides or, you know, things like that. I just think it's really cool. Like,
yeah.
Why not make it as easy as possible for a teacher to pick up your book and use it in their classroom? And I think this is a really cool way to
also, not to get on a huge tangent, I don't know. Look, we're not that old, okay? I'm 33. I understand that I'm not ancient. But when I was in high school and middle school, we read all of the classics. Like, I don't think we ever read a contemporary book.
See, I can't. In high school, we didn't.
No.
It was all classics. It was Hamlet and Scarlet Letter and all of that. But in grade school, my eighth grade teacher read us Holes.
Okay, I think I might have read Holes.
And I know we had one or two other books that year, but I, like, distinctly remember him reading Holes aloud. Like, it wasn't like we took turns. Every day we sat down and he read us, like, two or three chapters or something. So I distinctly remembered that and, like, talking through that book, too. But yeah, so that's probably the most current book that we read that I can remember.
I can't remember. I might have read that in the book club that I went to in school in the library. I don't know if we actually read that in class or not, because that's where I read a lot of more the more modern books, was I was in a book club. But yeah, I don't really remember ever reading them in school. And I just think, like, especially a book like Tristan Strong, like, that is so amazing that they're reading it. So
agreed. Agreed.
Yay, teachers.
Woohoo, teachers. Okay, yeah. Moving.
We have two anthologies that are coming out. The first one is Bridge to Elsewhere, which currently has a Kickstarter campaign, and I think that's going for another 2 weeks, so you still have time to donate to it. It features a story by Carlos Hernandez, and let me tell you, this sounds exactly like something a fan of Carlos Hernandez would want to read. So the synopsis for the anthology says, in the vastness of space, there's room for all types of adventures. Scientists seek to solve the mysteries of the universe. Explorers look for lost alien civilizations or new worlds to support life. Planet builders and planet smugglers create life and steal worlds. And some human spacefarers navigate with the help or hindrance of feline or feathered companions. The universe contains infinite possibilities, but while space is limitless, it's the people who travel it that make their adventures worth reading. And many of the decisions they make happen on the bridge of a spaceship.
I mean,
doesn't that sound cool?
Yeah, it does. It definitely like on topic. Like it fits very much the whole Carlos Hernandez like.
Yeah, definitely.
Flair.
Yeah. He wrote Sal and Gabby. In case there, I know it's a lot to remember. Yeah. Some people might still be trying to get used to it. So he wrote Sal and Gabby, and yeah, I mean, obviously this is right up his alley. So that's pretty cool. We also have a new anthology coming called Magic Has No Borders. This is by Sona Charapatra and Samira Ahmed, and it's an anthology of sci-fi, fantasy, myth, and legends, again, on brand for Rick Riordan Presents. And this one will include a story from Tracy Baptiste. And Tracy Baptiste did Moco Magic.
I believe so, yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I would read both of these anthologies even if I didn't know any of the authors that were in them. It sounds, and there are, Magic Has No Borders has some big names too. I think the big one that I was looking at is Sabah Tahir. So that one's pretty cool to have on there.
Yeah.
So, yay, anthologies and magic and sci-fi. We love it.
All the things.
Yes. Okay, today we are going to be talking about Daughter of the Deep spoilers. So if you haven't read Daughter of the Deep, do not listen to the rest of this episode. You can skip ahead to the chapter reviews. If that's what you're looking for, the timestamps will be in the show notes.
We said last chance. All right.
Run away, yeah. We said we were going to do it. We're going to do it. These are Daughter of the Deep spoilers. And I'm actually very excited for this. I was a little worried we wouldn't have enough to talk about. And then I started writing the doc and I was like, no, I still have lots of feelings about this. So if you want to listen to our non-spoiler review, go back to episode 4 and you can listen to the non-spoiler review of Daughter of the Deep.
Which was pretty great, if I do.
It was, yeah.
If I do say so myself.
There were, we like to toot our own horn here. There were a few things that I was very sad we weren't able to talk about in that first episode, which is basically why we wanted to do this one.
Yes. It's just basically all the things that we were like,
yeah,
we shouldn't talk about that. Dang it.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on.
And I think the big one for me, other than the main twist of the story, is just all of the animals. I call them animal sidekicks, and that almost feels wrong, because they are so much more than that.
It's sacrilege.
It is. Yes. It is a little bit. So let's start off easy, and then we'll get into the really exciting ones. But I just want to revisit Socrates, because Socrates was so cool. I really liked him and the way that he could communicate with Anna and just like show her what he needed and what he wanted from her and how she could kind of understand him. And then in the end, how he saves everyone. It was so cool.
Socrates is the best.
Yeah.
It takes me back to like watching Flipper and like dreaming of a life in which I have a dolphin, like, best friend who I could go swim with. And, like, yeah, I truly, truly love Socrates as a character in this story. Mm-hmm. not just because, like, oh, Socrates is a dolphin and he's cute and whatever, you know. No, but, like, they would not be there. No one would have survived this if it wasn't for Socrates. And, like, from the very beginning, Socrates knows, you know, that something bad is coming and can sense it and is trying to get to Anna. And, like, yeah, I love Socrates. And I love that there's this long tradition of their family having relationships with dolphins, so well cemented this relationship that there is a secret tunnel and a giant tank in the captain's quarters. Like, that's so cool. Like, yeah. Just, yeah, something about that just, like, makes my heart very happy.
Yeah, and I think you kind of said something there that reminded me, like, Socrates is very much a character in this book. He's not, like, okay, I love Top, and Top is awesome. Yeah. He's the cutest little dog ever. But Top feels very much more like a sidekick almost, and where he's just shows up there to be, like, emotionally supportive and look cute. And I'm fine with that. That is, like, he does his job perfectly. He gets all the treats. Socrates feels like he has a little more substance, which I think was intended because he tries to warn her at the beginning of the book, and then he helps them later on in the open ocean, and then at the end, obviously, helps as well. So, yeah, I just love that Socrates has, like, a meaty
role
in the book. Yes, thank you.
No problem. Yeah, no, that's more or less my thing, too. I could not even begin to describe how relieved I was when Socrates was still alive.
Yeah.
Because my brain, we didn't really know people at that school. Like, we got introduced very quickly, but after the inciting incident, like, there were only two, maybe three names tops that we knew that were in that school at the time. So, like, while it was sad, we didn't know anyone to be grieving over, whereas we had already met and had a moment to get to know Socrates.
Yeah.
And I was, like, worried that something happened, but I was like, no, there's no way that Rick introduces a dolphin best friend and then kills them right away. Like, no, there's no way. And then Socrates, like, pops back up, and I'm like, oh, thank God.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I 100% agree that Socrates has a little meatier of a role in the book than Top or, you know, some of the others. But, yeah, Socrates is definitely a character.
Yeah. Speaking of Top, though, I really love that Top is specifically an emotional support animal. Like, I don't want to say it's a new concept because I don't know how long, like, that specifically has been around. But I only learned about, like, legitimate emotional support animals that, like, your landlord can't tell you you can't have them if you're prescribed one. I just think that's really cool. And Top is so good at not only helping Esther, but everybody else. Like, he's got a good relationship with everybody else. And I love that he just knows when they need him.
Yeah. He's always there in a moment of need. Yeah, no, emotional support animals have gotten this, like, eye roll thing in the last probably 5 years or so. Because people were taking advantage of it and were trying to just basically carry their pets on airplanes and everywhere they wanted and trying to do things for free and insisting that their pets get to come with them into restaurants even though they weren't licensed. But there's a difference between, like, just wanting an animal with you all the time and actually needing an emotional support animal, which Esther does need.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Top is a valuable friend and tool for Esther. And, like, she could not function very well in the world without Top somewhere near her. Like, I can definitely see how that is a symbiotic relationship. Like, she needs Top, and Top obviously needs her, you know, to get fed and treats and belly rubs. You know, so, like, they really do kind of need each other to get through things. And so, yeah, it's a little different than what it's the joke it has become to some people. But for an actual, like, licensed emotional support animal, like, yeah, no. I thought it was really, really cute that it was done and done so well in Daughter of the Deep.
Mm-hmm. And I really liked the idea that there's always, like, a Harding has always had a Top. Like, that, and I remember reading on the Esther, like, breakdown spotlight thing on the Reed Riordan site that it was like, we don't know exactly who Top is, if Top is a direct descendant of the original Top or what. But either way, I just think it's cool that, like, that's part of the legacy of that family and the school is to have this dog.
Just like Anna's family has dolphins, they've all basically had a Socrates. I love that Top is kind of a, yeah. Also, the name Top, it's not something I would have thought to name a pup.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have, but it's kind of perfect. Like, he does kind of lose his mind and kind of spin around like a top. Like, he's, you know, a little fur ball of energy. So, like, yeah, I really enjoyed having Top in this book, especially as the as they move into Nemo's ship, as they move into the Nautilus, and Top seems to, like, he seems to have an extra sense going, like, he can kind of, like, he knows, like, where to stay away from things, and, like, it's kind of just kind of cute to see Top interacting with the Nautilus and all of that.
Yeah, he's very smart. Speaking of smart animals and creatures that interact with the Nautilus.
Wow. I teed that up and did not even try.
Yes, you did.
Damn. Sometimes things just work.
We're talking about Romeo, obviously. And oh my God, I was not expecting to love Romeo as much as I did, because, you know, he's so big and kind of scary that you expect him to be kind of a villain of the story or something, and it's the complete opposite of it. So he goes up to the Nautilus, and they try shocking him off of it, but he likes the electrical current because that's how octopuses communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And he was being affectionate with the ship, which is very, very funny to me.
Oh, yeah.
It was hilarious. But then after that, Anna gets the keytar and they do a little light show in order to communicate with him and play like songs and stuff. And so clever, because we know how intelligent octopuses are and lights and electrical currents and stuff. Like, they can understand that and communicate in those ways. And of course, when they change their camouflage and stuff, like, all of that has different meanings. And I was just so impressed with this part of the book. I think this is one of the most vibrant scenes in my head.
Mm-hmm. And I know that I was, okay, I'm one of those people that when I watch a movie, I can remember scenes from the trailer and I kind of keep a running tally of what we've seen.
Mm.
So I kind of keep, I know, like, oh, that scene's still upcoming, or like, we haven't seen that yet. So that's gotta be, you know, like, and thank goodness not all trailers, not all scenes in trailers make it into movies. Otherwise, I would know exactly what was going to happen in every movie I ever see. But in here, the cover of Daughter of the Deep has this giant octopus on it. And occasionally, I would just kind of glance at it and be like, where are we? Like, where is this thing? Because Romeo pops up very late in the story.
Yeah.
Like, we get a long way into the book before you meet Romeo. And knowing that the cover, you know, Romeo is important enough to make it onto the cover of the book, it just was like, I kept kind of waiting. Like, every time they talked about, like, the deep or, you know, I wonder if there's a creature down there or whatever, like, I held my breath every time because I was like, there's an octopus coming. A giant octopus. Like, it's coming. I know it is. Like, somewhere, somehow. But, yeah. So, I was really impressed with the Romeo stuff, too. Like, it was a really well thought out, great use of an octopus and all that we know about octopuses. And also explains why Rick gave us all of that lovely info about octopuses.
In the
slideshow at his live thing.
Yeah, the tour that we went to. Yeah. I completely forgot there was an octopus on the cover. So I none of those thoughts were inside my brain. But that's okay. It's a simple place up here. And I was more or less just expecting him to, like, try to take down the ship and them having to get away. And it was the total opposite. And then coming in the end and saving everybody was just so cool to me. So,
yeah,
I thought that was just really awesome.
Yeah, and trust me, I wish my brain did not work like that. I wish it could forget things, but it forgets the important things.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. Last, but definitely not least, maybe best. I mean, I have love for everybody, but Jupiter.
Jupiter!
Oh, my goodness. Jupiter is an orangutan who loves the Great British Bake Off.
Which we have in common.
Yes, we do. Both of us love the Great British Bake Off. And he was like, no turn off Mary Berry. And I was laughing. I'm trying to hold back commentary on Great British Bake Off because I was like, I love Mary Berry, but I also love Prue. And I think it's totally fine if you love both. Anyway, that is not the point of this podcast.
I'm pretty sure Jupiter would agree.
I think he would, yeah.
It may take him a minute to get past the loss of Mary Berry.
Yes.
She's
not dead.
In the show. Yeah. In the show. Of the show. Yeah, that's what I meant. But it might take him a minute to get past that, but I think once he did,
yeah,
I think he would, yeah, welcome Prue with open arms.
Absolutely. And just the fact that Jupiter's the one cooking everything, and they bring him on the Nautilus later, and he has, you know, full use of the kitchen, I thought was really brilliant. And the fact that he speaks in sign language and everything, and that's how they communicate, just, it bridges this gap between, you know, humans and animals, and he's so incredibly intelligent, and he kind of blew my mind when he came on, because when he's introduced, it's like, oh yeah, you know, Jupiter's cooking in the kitchen, whatever, and then this orangutan comes out, and you're like, wait a second.
Wait. Jupiter?
Yeah.
Like, at first I thought, like, whose name is Jupiter?
I know.
Like, they're parents, man. But it kind of fits for our little orangutan friend. No, I love how incredible Jupiter is with the interesting grocery options.
Yes.
Because, if I'm not mistaken, orangutans are vegetarians, so it makes total sense that, like, Jupiter's not, you know, they don't have a plethora of protein to use anyway. And so it makes sense that, like, Jupiter would want to just use the vegetables and things at his disposal. Not to mention all these algaes that apparently can duplicate a lot of things, including, like, butter and make really killer garlic bread, which I would definitely try because garlic bread is amazing. I just think it's really awesome that Jupiter has become this, like, maestro in the kitchen and can turn the weirdest algaes into the yummiest of things. And where would they be without Jupiter?
Yeah.
They would be eating strange, strange things.
Yes. Or a lot of dehydrated things that, like, they have to bring from the surface or something.
Instead, Jupiter has them all eating like kings.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I think the underwater gardens are really interesting. And you're right, the fact that they have to use the food that the ocean gives them, and not even just like fish or anything like that. We're talking about plant life. And to be able to replicate recipes like that is ingenious. And in the book, and Rick has also talked about the fact that, like, Nemo realized that if they kept fishing the oceans the way they did, that they wouldn't be able to maintain the populations, and that, like, vegetarianism really is better for the planet and everything. And I love that. Like, I'm not a vegetarian. I love eating meat, but I really respect the fact that he lived in this environment, looked around, and instead of taking advantage of it, knew how important it was to preserve it, not only for his own livelihood, but the livelihood of the planet. Like, that's a huge message to put in that book and this book, Daughter of the Deep.
Yeah, and it's kind of fitting based on what we learn about Nemo in this book and, like, all of the ways he was able to look ahead and see what was coming and create these things that even the best minds on planet Earth have not come up with in the, what is it, 100 years since he passed or whatever? Like, that's insane.
Yeah.
To be more than 100 years ahead of civilization, like, that's a mind.
That's literally a genius.
Yeah. And to have that person, like, be able to look around him and see the things that people these days can't necessarily wrap their minds around, like, oh, we definitely caused this. We definitely had an effect on this. Like, to be able to see that it might take a genius mind. It might take someone to actually, you know, make that observation and connect the dots and all that. So yeah, I thought it was very fitting and really remarkable.
Absolutely. So speaking of whether or not we saw something coming, I'm very curious if you realized Dev was the bad guy all along.
No.
Okay. I'm very
to
impressed.
To a point.
Okay. Because Kristen is very good. Like, she watches a lot of movies, and she is very good at knowing the beats of a movie or a book or stuff like that. So
there was a point at which I started to wonder and started to put it together. Because there's a thing. I don't know if it's a TV thing or whether it's in general just a pop culture thing. Because this is a book, not a TV show that we're reading. If a death isn't given enough time on screen, especially a significant death, which Anna's last remaining living relative dying in a tragic attack is pretty significant, and they did not give Dev a second thought. After she was forced to leave, because if Anna had her way, she would have run back and dug through the rubble and tried to find him. So, like, I'm not questioning Anna's motivation in all this. But, like, we leave him behind, and Anna has to keep barreling forward. Like, she has to just let her mind continue to focus.
She thinks about him a couple of times.
Yeah.
But, like, she kind of has to push that down because of everything else that's going on.
And that raised my hackles a little bit. Like, something's going on here. But I kind of let it go because I was like, maybe it's just me. It's never just me. It's a thing.
Yeah.
But like I was maybe it's just me. Maybe it's just, you know, we didn't know Dev. So maybe it was just supposed to be that, you know, she lost her entire family and now she's really on her own. But I want to say somewhere around the halfway point, maybe it was when they started talking about traitors. Like there was a point in the book, I can't remember exactly where they start to talk about like, maybe it's when they start looking at Hewitt and wondering, like, his role in the whole thing and whether he was playing both sides. Maybe that was when I started to kind of wonder if Dev might not be dead. Really seriously started considering, like, if Dev's not dead, where is Dev? And there's only really one option for where he is. And so I think that's about when I started to wonder if we were going to meet Dev again. And then, ta-da, he pops up.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think you have a really good point in that if you don't see the dead body, they might not be dead. I mean, unfortunately, / fortunately, if you love the character, that happens a lot in television shows if they want to walk back a death that the audience didn't like, or, you know, maybe they had that plan all along. And when we first lost Dev, I was like, I just didn't believe it. Like, that's usually my go-to thing is I just don't believe it until we have a solid answer for it. And then as the book continued on, I was trying to figure out who the person, you know, was that betrayed them and what was actually going on. And I was like, what if it's Dev? Like, it was just sort of a passing thought, nothing really concrete. And then, yeah, as you get closer to the end, I will say, like, I figured it out before the final reveal, before they really started getting heavy-handed with it. However, that is not the same thing as saying that it wasn't a good twist, because it was a fantastic
twist. Oh, no. It was well done.
Yeah, and I was still, like, shocked, even if I wasn't completely surprised, if that makes sense. But, because when the final reveal comes, you're just like, wow, he really did that to his own sister, and you kind of can't believe it.
Well, and, like, in those opening chapters, like, there's very few people that you get to meet that aren't in the freshman class, but, like, Anna makes a point to talk about his girlfriend, who, like, you know, was, like, marine biologist and, like, all this stuff and where she was going to school and, like, all that. It's basically, that person was basically the one human there that I feel like I kind of knew.
Yeah.
That I knew died, other than just the generic teachers and students.
God,
and
I forgot about his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
my
he
God.
Let her die. Like, just sacrificed her. And that, you know, that kind of set me on a, I could see that he, you know, I'm sure we'll get into this in a minute, but, like, with all of Dev's, like, justifications for this and trying to say, like, I gave them time to get everybody out. It's not my fault if, you know, everybody died. Like, I tried to warn them.
That's delusional.
Right. Like, he's trying to convince himself he's not responsible for it. But, like, you know, he had to have taken some stock of all the people that could and probably would be lost. And to think that he still thought it was worthwhile, like, that, yeah.
No. Yeah.
Anyway.
I think that's a really good segue into my next question, which is Dev unredeemable?
I don't want to say unredeemable, because I think Rick could do anything.
Yeah.
Fair. I do think that there is good in Dev, and I do think that his parents' deaths were twisted and used against him. And the Land Institute definitely used him and made him see things the way they wanted him to see things. So I do feel like there is room for him to learn about what his parents did, how his parents truly died. I mean, I know we get a bit of that at the end of the book here. But, like, if he really examines what happened and what led to it, I think he will have a chance to maybe bring some relief and some understanding to the situation and say, like, I was wrong. You know, he's going to need to admit that. He's going to need to admit that he never should have gone as far as he did. But I'm okay with Anna and all of them, you know, maybe not letting him have free reign of things. You know, like,
don't put him in a position of power.
Keeping him on a short leash until it's, you know, 100% proven. And I will say that towards the end of the story here, as Anna was kind of looking for ways to prove that Dev had changed, or that, you know, like, that Dev could change, and it started dawning on me, like, if the Nautilus trusts him, then maybe I would trust him. Like, if the Nautilus can someday let him run the ship, if the Nautilus someday responds to his, you know, his orders, then I might believe it. You know, the Nautilus is a pretty good judge of character,
yeah.
Killing her parents aside because he was pissed. And, you know, I get it. The Nautilus has proven to be a pretty good judge of character, and I would consider forgiving Dev wholeheartedly if the Nautilus forgives Dev.
Yeah. I think that's a really good point. When I put this question in here, I was firmly in the camp of, I think he can be redeemed to a point. I think that no one's ever going to forget what he did. Maybe they would be able to forgive him in some way in the future. But then you brought up his girlfriend, and now I'm like, that's... Like, okay, so he knew the school was getting attacked. He did try to warn them, but that depends on how hard he tried to warn them. Like, did he really give them enough time to get out? Was that kind of a setup thing? And was he having second thoughts when that happened? Either way, he knew Land Institute was going to attack HP Academy. And, I mean, that in and of itself is just, not only did you kill somebody that you supposedly cared about, but you killed a lot of people. Like, that is a terror attack, and that's awful.
And I think it would have been one thing if they would have lost HP, if they would have lost the buildings, the school, the resources, mm-hmm. and everything at their disposal. You know, if he would have faked a gas leak or something stupid and gotten everybody off campus, and then Land Institute attacks and they lose the entire infrastructure, that would have been a big enough loss to HP. Yes, they would have had to they would have had everybody there to rebuild.
But it would have set them back.
Right. And I think that is 100% forgivable.
Mm-hmm.
It's the mass death that is really hard to redeem. And granted, we don't know for sure that there were no survivors. We don't know who survived, and we're, you know, maybe Rick will gift us with a list or or some knowledge of that in the future. But, like, yeah, he really did cross a line. It's there's villain, and then there's, like, you know, a good person who does a bad thing.
Yeah.
And when you allow a large number of people to die because you feel, you know, wronged, that's kind of stepping over the line.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. However, I do think that motivation has a lot to do with this question of whether he's redeemable or not, because we know for sure that he basically, like, he's bitter because his parents died. He feels like the Academy got their parents killed, even though it was their choice to go and do what they did. And he also believes that tech could save the world. So he's kind of leaning toward the Land Institute, where they introduce the tech to the world, versus HP, which kind of wants to keep it for when humanity is ready. And he thinks that they're being shut out of their family legacy. And first of all, that just sounds like spoiled teenager to me, but whatever. Anna is, I think, a lot more grounded and smarter than her brother. But I feel like, I think you're right. I think part of it was he was bitter over his parents' death, and then he allowed Land Institute to manipulate him. And I think that he's done a very bad thing. And honestly, if, you know, I'm not really sure that he is redeemable. However, I think that he could work toward being a better person actively, and we could trust him more and more and more. But, like, it's going to be really hard to forget this. Like, really hard.
Yeah. And I do think it's fair that the blame doesn't entirely fall on his shoulders. Yes, he made it possible. But the Land Institute does have a role to play here. They are ultimately responsible for what went down. And so I think maybe there is some room, some wiggle room for him to get back into people's good graces and to earn his way in. But he did an absolutely horrific, terrible thing.
Yeah. And I think there's an argument there too for, okay, maybe he gave Land Institute some information and they attacked the school and it's not really what he wanted. But he was kind of trying to justify it throughout the book too. So I feel like, yeah, he's just delusional and misguided, and I don't really know how that's going to work out in the end.
Yeah. I ultimately, when the whole thing went down and we, like, first re-met Dev as the real Dev.
Yeah.
My first thoughts were, Rick, how dare you? Because I felt so bad for Anna. Yeah, and I'm like, so this is her only remaining family member, and she thought he was dead, and now he's back. But not only is he back, but he's with the bad guys. Like, he's on the other side of things. Like, how awful is that? So I was like, how dare you, Rick?
How dare you? That was kind of my next thought, too, is, like, Anna has been through so much. Like, so much. She lost her parents. She thought she lost her brother. She lost her school. She discovered her family's legacy. And that's a whole other complicated thing, because the Nautilus killed her parents. And she's got to figure out how this submarine, you know, how she can have a relationship with this living, artificially intelligent thing. And then her brother comes back, and it's just like a whirlwind, you know? Yeah. Like, how do you wrap your head around something like that?
Thank goodness for her friends.
Yeah, really. I mean, she has such supportive friends.
If it was not for the two of them, there's no way Anna gets through this, like, at all. I mean, she's a strong character, but she really does have a fantastic support system, especially in her two girlfriends that have been with her and who know her and who are, you know, there to be supportive and helpful, especially as Anna's lineage is revealed and she now is the one who's in charge, and she never asked for that and doesn't know how to do what she's supposed to do. And, you know, they're there for her every step of the way there. And it just proves that, like, while Anna doesn't have any, like, family left that she can 100% trust, Dev, she does have a chosen family that she can absolutely trust 100%. And especially, like, Esther, and how brilliant and intuitive in her own right. Like, Esther has this way of just kind of getting to the heart of things that is incredible. And so it's, thank goodness for them.
Yeah. And I think a lot of credit also has to go to Anna herself, because she is such a grounded, realistic person who has a lot of forgiveness inside her body, because she brings Dev to the gardens. And she brings Dev to say hi to the ship, and then they go down to the gardens to say goodbye to their parents. I was, like, skimming through this part to do this doc, and I started crying again because that moment is so profound. And it's kind of juxtaposed by the fact that he keeps thinking that she's punishing him, that he's being led somewhere so that he could be in a worse place than he was in that jail cell. But she just wants her brother back.
Yeah.
She just wants her family, her only remaining family. And I'm just very curious about what future they have together, because this is going to be a thing between them for a long time. And their trust in each other, especially Anna's trust in Dev, is zero. It is at 0%. And they need to rebuild that. And it's going to take some time, but I'm very curious as to, like, how that'll happen.
Yeah, I did love that as she's trying to show him what he was giving up by going through all of this, and what he ultimately did give up because he was destined to be the captain of the Nautilus, yeah, and now has, you know, very little chance at ever captaining the ship. As she's, you know, walking him through the Nautilus and taking him to the gardens and, you know, all of that, I was really struck by how often he was like, so is this it? Is this what you're, you know,
yeah,
is this my punishment? Like, you're just trying to, you know, break my heart. You're trying to show me that, you know, it just goes to show that, like, he thinks the worst of absolutely everyone. And maybe it's, you know, Land Institute coming out on him, like the things that they had him convinced of and the things that they used against him. Maybe it's part of that and maybe he'll grow out of it. But yeah, as they're going through that, like, that just kind of kept weighing me down. Like,
yeah,
come on, Dev. Like, can't you see that she is trying to get back to some semblance of normal, some semblance of, this is my brother whom I love and I trust. Like, she wants to give you a chance and, like, just look around and, you know, take what she's giving you. So, I don't know. This is one of the reasons why I know this is a standalone book. But this is one of the reasons why I don't think that Rick is necessarily done in this world, that he may give us a future book, is because the place he left Anna and Dev is so fraught and unsettled, and there's so much to do with them that he could do with them, and getting Dev in a place where he could be trusted, or maybe a place where Dev doesn't trust himself. Like, maybe Dev comes to terms with the things that he did and doesn't allow himself to be put in a position of leadership later on. Like, you know, like, as he grows. So I do think there's a lot of room for more stories in this, yeah, world, so on.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting, too, to compare the way that he thinks about everything to Anna's friends who trust her completely. I mean, we talked about in the spoiler-free episode about how incredible it was to see all of these kids working together, trusting in each other, and being vulnerable with each other and just open and communicative and stuff. And, like, Dev is the sore thumb sticking out here. Like, the way that he thinks is not like the way that anybody else thinks. And while I think that's not necessarily a bad thing, he obviously has twisted reality to kind of fit this image to confirm that HP Academy is this terrible place that ruined everything, that took away his legacy. And Anna shows him it didn't. Like, it's right here. You're the one that took it away. And that probably does hurt. It wasn't intentional, yeah, but it's gotta hurt.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Good point, though, because the last thing I really wanted to talk about here was sequel possibilities, and I've got a lot of thoughts on this. But first, I want to talk about Anna and Gemini, yes, because we kind of danced around this a little bit in our spoiler-free chat, and I just want to know, do you ship Anna and Gemini?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They
really kind of snuck up on me. I mean, it's not like I didn't think it was going to happen, because they're polar opposites in so many ways, and that is always just perfect for a story where, oh, hey, let's actually be friends, which is kind of where this book leaves off. Like, yes. They've become friends, they trust in each other, and that was beautiful, and I didn't need any more romance than that. However, I really like the idea of this shark who is actually a lot more vulnerable and open than you would think he is. And Anna, who has a lot going on, but is learning to rely on him as not only a friend, like she does with Nalina and Esther, but also as like a kind of bodyguard or somebody who might know things that she doesn't know, because he's also a very intelligent person. And I just think there's a lot of room for a future of them together, either as closer friends, which I would be fine with, or maybe they start dating or something. I think that would be really cool.
I mean, yeah, I will say, I think I jumped onto the gem train. I don't know. It sounds so dumb. I think I jumped onto the, yes, you know, no kiss train earlier than maybe we were supposed to, because there's just this, maybe it's the romance reader in me. There's just something about two people who definitely have very similar goals and a very similar, like, worldview, because while he's a shark and she's a dolphin, they both believe in the HP way. Like, they're still definitely, you know, on the same track. They see things a little differently, but like, they're on the same path. And there's just something about the way that they interact with each other, even at the beginning of the story when Anna's, you know, still kind of hates him because of what he did to Nalina in the cafeteria all those years ago. She has this grudge, and it's one of those things, those misunderstandings from childhood that just fester, and it exists, and it's a thing. But I love that as this book goes on, she sort of realizes that Jem probably wasn't trying to, like, make Nalina's life miserable. He just really didn't think it through. Like, a classic, yeah, you know, young boy,
yeah,
was not realizing that what he did made her life miserable or made her life harder. And I love that, you know, a simple little misunderstanding like that has been blown up into this grudge and has created the, you know, the division between them. And as more and more as he puts himself on the line for Anna and wants to be there for her and is trying to help and protect and not get in her way, but also, you know, be there for her, I had a soft spot for Jem very, very quickly, as is always the way. And yeah, I really, really love the two of them. I'm with you. If it ends up just being like a really close symbiotic kind of friendship where they need each other because they know, you know, the right hand knows what the left is doing and they think better together, great. Like, I love those kinds of friendships, but I would also be totally good if they got together.
They smooched.
Lots of kissing. All the kissing. Yeah, no. I think they would make a really fantastic pair in whatever way that ends up being.
Yeah. One character that surprised me a lot more than Jem and I did was Hewitt, Professor Hewitt, because he was not a bad guy, like, at all, actually, and was very good. And I think that I love stories like this where there's a character who either grew up thinking a certain way or grew up in a certain situation where, like, that was the norm, and then they actively choose to do the opposite. You see this a lot with people, you know, who grew up in homophobic households, who once they learn more about that, they go, actually, like, that's a bad thing, and they actively choose to work on their own mindset and to be a better person. And Hewitt is kind of the same way. Is like, he worked at Land Institute. He thought their way was the right way. And then as he kept working there, he realized that it really wasn't, and that he wanted to do something different, which is why he went to HP Academy and worked there. And he, in my mind, he's still kind of a gray character because he's not the cuddliest of people,
no,
first of all. But secondly, you know, actually, that's pretty much part of it, is he's a lot harder on the kids because I think he knows the truth of what the Land Institute is like. And so he's a lot more regimented with them. But because he's actively choosing to be a better person, I kind of fell in love with him at the end there. Like, I was really not expecting that.
Yeah, I will say, I think I have a bit of a soft spot for Hewitt. We were initially supposed to consider him as one of the possibilities for the traitor. And he played his role quite well.
Yes, he did.
But you're right. Like, he really is, like, a good guy. A very stern, teachery kind of good guy. But I quite like his brand of teaching. I like the trust that he put in them when he finally had to. Like, when he had no other option. I mean, it might have seemed easy to be like, okay, fine, these are the kids and we're going to teach them. Like, even then, like, he was a good teacher trying to introduce them to all of this, trying to, like, ease them in.
He's a less insane Mad-Eye Moody.
I mean, basically, yeah. Like,
somebody who's seen the other side up close and personal and is trying to prepare these kids for their future.
Yeah. It, that pretty much describes him. But I'm glad that Hewitt is doing better because he quickly deteriorates.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because he had cancer and then they figured out how to cure his cancer, which is just insane. But
the Nautilus,
like,
man.
Yeah, I mean, that's so cool. And, like, there's just, I want to see more of him, especially now that the kids have gone through what they've gone through without him, because he was kind of out of it the whole time.
Yeah.
To watch him bounce back and go, okay, you got your taste of what the real world is like. Let's keep going. Let's, you know, dig deeper. And that is something I just really want to read.
It's also very smart of Rick to put Hewitt down in this first book, in this story. Like, give Anna a chance to step up and really be the leader in his stead. Like, Rick found a way to take Hewitt out of the picture without killing Hewitt. So now we still have this chance to see her with a true mentor and someone who really has a lot to teach her, even though she still had that opportunity to step out on her own and do what she had to do.
Yeah.
Like, he did a very good job of giving us an opportunity to still get more out of Hewitt in the future, which is good. Sounds good to me.
Yeah. And I think he did that really well, even with Luca and Ophelia in the picture, because those are really the only three adults in the book, I think, pretty much.
Yeah.
And even with Luca and Ophelia there, Anna had to really figure a lot of this out on her own, because while they had some information about the Nautilus did not respond to them the way that she responds to Anna. So I think that it was really cool. Like, the reason why I love reading middle grade and young adult is because it puts all of the power into kids' hands. And, you know, kids are the future, and when you're that age, you want to be the one with the power. You want to be the one that's special, who saves the world. And when you're a little bit older, I think it's just nice to see the generation after you taking care of themselves and taking care of the world and knowing that, like, your legacy lives on in the next generation and stuff. So I just really like the way all of this was handled. And I really like Luca and Ophelia on their own as characters. Like, I think they're very interesting, but I just really like that they kind of took a backseat to Anna.
I did not like Ophelia specifically.
Really?
When we first met her.
Oh, okay.
I loved Luca.
Okay.
He quickly, you know, he's silly. Yeah. And he has a lot of, like, dumb jokes and whatever. So he's easy to love. But when we met Ophelia, first of all, I thought she might have been the traitor.
So did I. I was a little scared.
I didn't trust her. I wanted to know what she had to say, but I very quickly was not sure of where her loyalties actually lied. And I was like, I don't know if Luca's in on this, but I, you know, she might be working on her own. And if she's been able to snow Luca all this time, like, you know, she's going to be a formidable foe. I'm really glad that's not the case, because I do love that Ophelia has the ability to be, you know, the adult woman in this situation, because we do have, you know, Hewitt and Luca, but Anna has no parents, mm-hmm. and, has not had a ton of, you know, maternal guidance, even if Ophelia has no maternal role in her life. But, like, just having an older woman to talk to and to, you know, work through things in her life with, I do trust Ophelia now. After everything that went down and how helpful Ophelia was and all that, I trust her now. But, man, for a long time, I couldn't justify that Ophelia had no other motives.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't sure of her. I'm glad that she didn't, because yeah. I really do love her and Luca, and I like their role at Lincoln Base, and I like what they've, you know, they've done, but, man, I was unsure at first.
Yeah. So was I, so I'm glad I wasn't alone there. Okay, to kind of wrap up this section, I just want to lay out basically where we are at the end of this book. So the school's blown up, but Esther wants to rebuild it. They have all the treasure that was on the ship, which was, you know, a bit. There was a bit there.
Yeah.
They'll be using Lincoln Base, and they'll be able to go back and forth because of the Nautilus. The Nautilus is alive, and Anna is Captain Nemo now, and she obviously has a little bit of a complicated relationship with the ship because the ship killed her parents, and Land Institute is very much still a threat. We didn't even technically see Land Institute. We saw, like, their freshman class and Dev and, you know, a couple other... Yeah.
Yeah.
But really, Land Institute is still this looming figure. And the kids have so much to learn still. Like, we literally just scratched the surface of not only the tech, but also the ocean and everything they can do with that, with the ship. Because as Anna keeps captaining the ship, they'll learn more about it and they'll develop a stronger bond and everything. Like, dear Rick Riordan, there is so much left to tell. And I think we mentioned this on last week's episode. Rick has basically said he has no plans for a sequel right now because he's got a lot of other stuff on his plate. He wants to get through that first, but he's not saying no to a sequel. And I'm telling you, Mr. Riordan, that there's so much potential for a sequel here, and I think that it could end up being even bigger and more amazing than what Daughter of the Deep was.
I 100% agree. I think that it's probably more of a when will he have time to do this rather than a will he ever do this.
Because he clearly loves and knows the source material.
Yes. And I think that there's a lot of potential in these characters to be a whole world and series of their own. And he wrote Daughter of the Deep. I think it was more of like a passion project. Like, he really wanted to touch this story of Nemo and the Nautilus. And, you know, I can see how an idea like that just kind of picks away at your brain. And meanwhile, he's trying to develop Percy's world in all of the, you know, the glory. We love it.
Yeah. I think he said Daughter of the Deep has been in his brain for like 12 years.
Right. Like, so I can see wanting to get the story out there and saying, okay, I've done it. I wrote the book I wanted. It's out there. You know, thank goodness it's done. But I think this is going to be a world that is going to be a bit of a retreat for him, especially with all the Percy stuff going on, with the show and the new, you know, standalone stories and all of that. As much as we all love Percy, I do think Rick may take advantage of Daughter of the Deep being a completely separate world, a bit of a departure, an escape, a vacation, if you will. From some of the pressure of building the Percy universe and all of its glory, that I'm really hoping that he'll take advantage in 4 years, 5 years, maybe, and put together a second Daughter of the Deep book or make a plan for future books or something. I really do think he's not done.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's going to want to play more, and I'm just trying to be patient and not demand, want, just request other books, because it's such a great world.
And I think that this book ends very well. Like, I'm very satisfied with it. I just loved it so much that I want more, essentially. And, you never know. Once they shoot the movie and that comes out, that could kind of reinvigorate him and give him some more ideas while he's like hashing out the story for the script and everything. Like that kind of stuff usually sparks some inspiration. So
for sure.
Maybe we'll get something.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, I'm done.
Done begging. Now it's time to get into our chapter reviews.
All right. This week, we read chapters 15 and 16. Chapter 15 is entitled, A God Buys Us Cheeseburgers. You know, for a chapter that's all about the Tunnel of Love, that's I think that's a missed opportunity for some craziness in that chapter
title. Yeah.
I mean, A God Buys Us Cheeseburgers is funny, but, like, there's a lot of weird chaos.
happened in this chapter. It was just full of stuff.
Yeah. So, okay, here's our quick recap. Starving, in desperate need of a shower, and looking for a water source to message Chiron, Percy, Annabeth, and Grover arrive in Denver. At the end of their Amtrak ride, a car wash is the place for Percy to send his first Iris message, and it ends up reaching Luke at the big house at Camp Half-Blood. Yes, I know. Then they pop into a diner, only to be joined for lunch by Ares. While he may have bought the cheeseburgers, it wasn't without a request of his own. Our trio head to an abandoned amusement park just in time to fall into one of Hephaestus's traps in the Tunnel of Love. It's a good thing Percy's Poseidon's kid, or things may have ended a bit differently.
Very true.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start at the beginning here a little bit. The whole Iris message thing.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I think that calling it IMing,
I know, right?
It's not instant messaging. It's Iris messaging. It was just really clever and funny.
Oh my God. Do kids know what IMing is?
Oh no. Don't say that, Kristen.
For those that don't know, back in the day, one of the most used programs on your computer with your dial-up internet was AIM, AOL Instant Messenger.
I can't believe we're describing this.
It was basically like text messaging on your computer.
Do they call anything IMing anymore? It's like DMing on Twitter.
Right? I don't think people use IMing as a term.
My God.
Yes. Moving on. It's quite delightful for those of us that grew up in the AOL Instant Messenger generation because, Good times. Away messages.
Yes.
Anyway.
There were a lot of emo song lyrics in the away messages.
Yeah. So the learning the ins and outs of Iris messaging, and it's going to come in incredibly handy and later on down the road. We know that. We use it for another, 12 books?
Yeah.
Like, they come in handy.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. I just love that there is a Greek way, a good way for Greek demigod children to talk to people since they can't really use technology.
Right, exactly.
It's kind of delightful that there is a method.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. So in this Iris message, they are looking for Chiron, but they get Luke instead.
We just both kind of rolled our eyes.
I mean, okay, I have to ask, when you read this, did you trust Luke on your first read through? Like, did you have your misgivings, or did you think he was, like, you know, a good guy?
I'm going to be real honest. I don't 100% remember. However, knowing me, I probably did trust him. I probably had my questions because, like, why are you being so pushy about the shoes, Luke? Huh? Why are you so concerned about the shoes?
Why are the shoes important to you, huh?
Yeah. I think because Annabeth trusted him, I trusted him. And I do remember a feeling of betrayal on Annabeth's behalf when we run into that later on. So, yeah, I probably did trust him. I probably was questioning things, but hoping that he wasn't a bad guy, because if Annabeth had a crush on him, I probably would have a crush on him. So, you know, didn't want him to be bad.
I trusted him.
Really?
Which is
like
weird.
100%?
I did not see his betrayal coming.
Wow.
Which is weird.
Yeah.
Even with the foreshadowing.
You were young and naive.
Apparently. Even with the pretty obvious foreshadowing.
Yeah.
Like, and, you know, pokes at Luke in this chapter alone, Yeah, I trusted him. So it's very weird to me because I never trust characters like that. Like, I usually am the skeptic and I'm like, oh, he's got, you know. No, definitely. This one definitely got me. So, yeah. Luke is a shady little punk. And I will say, Percy's, like, kind of absolute trust in Luke is a little odd to me, considering all of the all of the people he's come across in his life who have misrepresented themselves or who have not been great to him. You know, he's had friends, quote unquote friends, not Grover. Grover's a friend, but like he's had people come in and out of his life who have not been great. And he walks into Camp Half-Blood and yes, he's friends with Grover. And because Grover kind of trusts Annabeth, he trusts Annabeth, but like he is all about Luke. Thanks to those training sessions and all that, like, you can tell he really thinks Luke is, like, the person to look up to. Mm-hmm. And it kind of bugs me that Percy wasn't a little more discerning.
I feel like that makes sense to me because he walks into Camp Half-Blood, which is basically an oasis. It's a place where he can be safe from the outside world. He learns to trust Annabeth very quickly because of everything they've already gone through, and it's only halfway through the book. And she trusts Luke. Also, Chiron trusts Luke. And Luke is a mentor figure, and all the other kids kind of look up to Luke. I think they... So, Callie has the zoomies, and I think she just knocked her head on the door. Oh my god, I wonder if you can hear that in the recording. Are you okay, Callie?
She's not out there.
She'll be back. She has the zoomies. Oh my god, that was so funny. This was a serious conversation about trust.
We're having a serious moment.
Okay, so yeah, our decision to leave in all the Callie moments, it's real great.
It's proven itself this week.
Yeah. Okay, so I was talking about Luke. All of the other campers look up to him. I think even Clarice, like, kind of respects his authority and stuff. So it actually doesn't bother me too much that he trusts Luke. Also, I think that he's fighting so many outside forces that he can't even, like, look inside to see if there's anything going on there.
I mean, I guess that's fair.
Yeah.
It just bugs me. I know. Percy, you should know everything all the time. What is wrong with you? Anyway, moving on. Okay, so then, after the Iris message, what is with the guy with the boombox, by the way? Was that just, or the car with the radio, whatever it was it just a ploy to get him alone with Luke? Like, it had to have been, yeah. Right? Okay, because I kept wondering if, like, we were supposed to, like, know?
No, I don't what was think going
on.
So.
I do love, like, how there is a whole story going on in the background. We have no idea what it is, but like the guy's radio shuts off and then he starts yelling and then Annabeth and Grover are like laughing. Yeah. Like there's a whole story there that we're not gonna get. And it just cracks me up that Rick's like, you know what? We'll just throw these details in there. Why not? Yeah. It'll be fun. Okay. So they leave the car wash looking for something to eat and they go to this diner. And they're basically about to beg this waitress to feed them, despite the fact that they have nothing in their pockets. Yeah. And I'm really curious how they planned on figuring that out. Like,
well, I think Grover was about to cry. Like, maybe they were just gonna, like...
try and get this woman to take innocent. Pity on them. Yeah. Yeah. Or offer to wash dishes. I mean, Percy has to be pretty good at that, right?
You would think.
Like, really quick. Like, I got this. Like,
yeah.
So maybe that was part of it. I don't know. But it just cracked me up because I was like, they went in there to eat and had no idea how they were doing it. But before they can do more than bat their eyes at the waitress, someone pulls up outside on a motorcycle. A really creepy motorcycle.
Very interesting motorcycle. So I saw somebody point this out on TikTok maybe a month or so ago, and I think I brought it up to you back then. I don't think I've mentioned it on the podcast, but, you know, perfect timing because it's in this chapter. But Ares shows up to the diner on a motorcycle, and it's described as the seat was leather, but leather that looked like, well, Caucasian human skin. That is an intense visual for a middle grade book.
Yeah.
Also, who?
Well, I'm assuming they're his enemies.
Maybe, a human that crossed him or something. Percy really should be a little more careful around this guy.
I mean, yeah. Especially since that's the detail he got from it. Like, he's looking at this human, you know, this creature. It's not a human, but looks human.
Yeah.
He's looking at this person who's, like, bigger than life and, you know, just this giant ball of black angst, basically. And Percy is just like, I'm gonna poke it.
Yeah. Well, I think Aries has that effect on people, unfortunately, but I thought it was really funny that Annabeth and Grover kind of weren't as affected as Percy was.
I kind of think Aries was, like, channeling
probably,
it.
Probably, like, yeah.
Like, I can get this
just
kid.
Just give me an excuse.
Right? Like, I want to poke, like, please, please piss me off. Please. Yeah. No, for sure. For sure. So, yes, Aries steps in, buys the cheeseburgers, and gives them a task. And Percy basically wants to be like, here's my, you know, middle finger, and walk out of the diner. Like, he wants nothing to do with this. He's like, we have a quest. We don't need your quest. Leave me alone. And Annabeth's like, dude, you can't do that. Like,
yeah.
You cannot. First of all, it's Ares. Second of all, you can't do that to any god. Like, we have to do this. So that takes them to the amusement park, the abandoned amusement park, where they pilfer some new clothes. Good fun. I quite liked that whole bit, by the way. And then make their way to the Tunnel of Love, which is a whole debacle.
Yeah.
All on its own. I really just have to ask, why can't it be Follow the Butterflies?
Yeah, I saw this a couple of minutes ago, and I had to hold my laughter in because that was so funny. Imagine what the scene is going to look like in the television show. Imagine it.
I'm going to die.
It's going to be horrible. Kristen always comes and yells for me when there's a spider so that I can kill it. And yeah.
I'm afraid of spiders.
Mm-hmm.
Karen has other fears.
Yes.
And so we trade these off.
We do. Grasshoppers and moths. I don't know why I chose the weirdest things to be afraid of.
So I defend her from those,
yep.
Which there were quite a few in our first domicile.
Yes.
Where we lived together the first time. I defend her from those, and she defends me from the spiders. Yeah. And sometimes she has to kill some incredibly gross spiders.
We had a wolf spider.
It was big.
Not that long ago.
Really close to me, and I did not lose my cool. I'm very proud of myself.
Yeah.
Anyway.
You were very calm.
Yes. Anyway. Yeah. No. I'm not looking forward to seeing this scene. Probably only to be matched by Arachne's appearance later on in the series, you know, in the Percy world. But it's going to be a cool experience, we'll put it that way, because this is kind of insane. Hephaestus is a genius, and I love that we quickly get downloaded with this whole tale, because if you're not, as a kid especially, if you're not familiar with the Aries Aphrodite love situation, especially with Hephaestus as her husband, and we quickly learn from Annabeth what they're walking into, and it's literally in a couple of pages, because boom, then they're in this Tunnel of Love ride fetching a shield, and Hephaestus's trap has been set, and, you know, here we go. So I thought it was really, really well done on Rick's part, getting all of that in there and doing it in such a way that you didn't necessarily see what was coming, but then it's like, oh, of course, this is one of Hephaestus's traps. Like, that makes total sense. And it also makes sense why Ares wanted them to do it instead of himself.
Exactly.
But thank goodness Percy is a child of Poseidon, because they do make it through all of that. Thank goodness, because of the water and the boat aspect. If this was a car racing Tunnel of Love, they would be in really big trouble.
Yes, they would.
But they escape, thanks to Percy's abilities and Annabeth's stellar timing.
Yes.
Thank goodness for her. They make it out of there with a little touch of Grover and Luke's flying shoes.
Yes.
Rolling my eyes some more. I mean, they do come in handy before they don't. So yeah, that pretty much wraps up our little summation of the chapter, but we should probably do favorite quotes. and favorite moments. So, Karen, do you want to go first this time?
Yeah, this was Percy thinking. I kind of truncated the quote a little bit, but he basically says, I wondered if our ratings had been any good. This just really made me laugh because of all the things to wonder after that whole debacle, he's like, I wonder if a lot of people were watching.
Olympus, did you all tune in? Let us know.
Do I get a cut? Do I get some royalties? Yeah. Cut me a check.
Mine comes from Percy as he's meeting Ares, and he says, I wanted to punch this guy, but somehow I knew he was waiting for that. Ares' power was causing my anger. He'd love it if I attacked. I didn't want to give him the satisfaction.
Yeah.
Go, Percy. Very good. I think this was when they get back. Mm. It wasn't when he first met him, but it was, like, when they got back from the Tunnel of Love, and Percy was ready to punch a fool. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do our favorite moments. Karen, what was yours?
Mine was Annabeth knowing exactly when to jump out of the boat to get maximum height. She's like, yeah, it's just physics, and Percy would have been wrong, and he trusted her, and everything went well, and I just love that he is not this kid who's so full of himself not to realize that Annabeth is smarter than him in some things, and he trusts her, and you just don't get that a whole lot in books like this where there's, you know, a boy and a girl who obviously kind of like each other and don't really know how to handle it, and he's just like, yep, Annabeth knows better, let's do this. It's a very supportive friendship and later on relationship between the two of them.
Agreed. Definitely agreed. Mine was Percy keeping his cool when he was being baited by Ares. Basically my quote. I just really love that there are not a lot of young male heroes in books who are not impulsive, mm-hmm. and like, and Percy can be very impulsive. Mm-hmm. He has his moments.
But he's also kind of self-aware.
Right. Like, he's a thinker. And here, while earlier in the chapter, he had wanted to knock Ares' teeth in, like, was really annoyed and wanted to punch him. He, you know, he didn't, thanks to Annabeth kind of mentioning it to him. But when he gets back and is really pissed, he still manages to hold himself back. Like, this is what he wants. Don't rise to his challenge. Like, just let him go. And he does, and, you know, they may not have left on the best of terms because, you know, Ares and Percy are constantly at odds. But it was as good as could be expected, really, to be honest. And that takes us into chapter 16, which is entitled, We Take a Zebra to Vegas. See, now this is a little more.
Very good visual there.
Yes, yes. I mean, they're not riding a zebra, but they take one.
Yeah.
Okay, so quite a bit happened in this chapter, so here's the best summation I can give you. The trio ride with a zebra, a lion, and an antelope to Vegas, where they spring the animals. During the ride, Annabeth and Grover finally tell Percy about Talia and the year that Annabeth and Luke made it to camp, which we were all kind of waiting for, and I know, yeah. Percy was waiting for, too. And I'm glad that he let them have the time,
yeah,
that they needed.
Because he knew some stuff, but he knew that he had to wait for them to feel comfortable.
Yeah, which is awesome. After their good deed, they stumble into the Lotus Casino, where no kid would ever want to leave, only to be saved by Percy, of all people. And by the time they get out, 5 days have passed, leaving only one day to complete the quest. Whew. Okay. Yeah. Lots to kind of touch on here. Okay, so Talia, punk, yeah. daughter of Zeus.
Yes.
I'm really, as I said, as we kind of touched on in the recap, I'm really glad that Percy gave Annabeth and Grover the space to kind of come to him about it. He knew there was a story there. He knew that they were kind of holding back, but he gave them their time. And I'm really glad he did, because it allowed them to be a little more honest about what happened with Talia. And then he sees Talia.
Yeah, this so prophecy count five. We're Woo-hoo! At five now.
Number five.
Does Percy, this is a genuine question, does Percy know what Talia looks like? Because I felt like that was, like, actually her. Like, they were literally communicating. It wasn't just, like, a dream vision. Version of her. And I can't remember if he saw her, like, in a vision or a dream or something previously, or if there was, like, because they've talked about Talia before, but does he actually know what she looks like?
I don't think so.
So this really was, like, her infiltrating his dream then?
Well, because I'm trying to think, and, like, there aren't any pictures of her, because she never actually made it to camp.
Right.
So it's not like Luke or somebody would have a picture of Talia.
Right.
So, although him and Talia were together for a time, before Annabeth, like before they picked up Annabeth.
Yeah.
So maybe.
I mean, either way, it's a prophecy. So, like, it's not like dreaming of somebody you've never seen before and getting their image, right?
Yeah, but you're right. Like, it is kind of interesting that they are communicating, not necessarily just a vision-y kind of thing. But yeah, he kind of pictures her in all her glory, and we know because we've read the books and know what Talia looks like, that it was her.
Yeah.
But I love that she's kind of punk. Like, it's not what I would picture for a child of Zeus, so no. I kind of love it.
Yeah, I definitely do too. And I think that she's so cool, especially later on in the books when she gets a little more time to show off what she can do. She's just a really neat character.
Yeah.
My other favorite thing about this scene was Annabeth's beads and her talking about them. The centaur in the prom dress, do we ever get that story?
I don't think we have.
Because I really want to know.
If Rick ever wants to give us, like, a short story present for, like, a Christmas or an anniversary for Percy or something, he should give us some of the bead stories because... there might be another one or two that we don't know the story.
There's one in here, a Greek trireme on fire, which is a ship.
Yes.
I had to Google that. I mean, I feel like there's a lot to talk about, and especially if you want to see young Annabeth in a story, like, that would be cool.
And it wouldn't have to be long.
No.
Very short.
Yeah.
Just give us a little bit of a taste of why she has a centaur and a prom dress bead. That would be very cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so while they're in this truck, Percy talks to zebras, which is him experimenting with other parts of his abilities.
Right, yeah.
We got him underwater, so we got to kind of touch on a few others, but he can talk to horses and communicate with horses.
Yeah.
And I love that he's kind of taken aback, but quickly is like, yeah, that's a thing.
Yeah.
All right. I can talk to zebras.
It's a neat trick.
Right?
Like, it would prove useful.
Yeah. So they, you know, they talk to the animals. Grover can talk to the lion, apparently, which is kind of an odd matchup for me, but sure.
we'll go with it.
Yeah, we're just going to fly with that. Grover is able to kind of communicate with the lion. Percy talks to the zebra. They figure out kind of what's going on, and they let them free, thank goodness. And
can you imagine, though, these guys who put the meat in the zebra's cage and the radishes or whatever it was,
turnips
in the lion's cage? Like, come on.
They were just being mean.
Yeah, like, that is cruel. That is not even just like, okay, we don't really care, you know, we're just going to try to ship them as quickly as we can. That is intentional cruelty.
Yeah.
And I'm very mad about it.
Yes. Yes. I really wish Annabeth had left them a present and done something awful to them or something, but they didn't have time for that.
Yeah.
So they set the animals free, and then they leave the truck, just basically want to put it behind them, and they're kind of walking along the strip looking for something, food, lodging, whatever, trying to figure out what their next move is going to be. And they stumble into the Lotus Hotel and Casino.
I love the Lotus Hotel and Casino. I know that it's a bad place. I know this. But I am obsessed with the very idea of it. Oh my gosh. I just think it's so cool. And it is such a clever way to throw a huge wrench in their plans because they were ahead of schedule.
Mm-hmm.
They're like halfway across the United States. They have tons of time left. And all of a sudden, they lose like 5 days by going in this hotel. And it just like takes the tension up to 100. And all of a sudden, you're scrambling and everything. I think it's a genius ploy. And there's so much, of course, like Nico, you know, like there's that later on. So like the Lotus Hotel has a lot of significance in the series. And the first introduction of it is just crazy and weird. And I just love how it all operates. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. I just have to point out that of all the people to keep their head and to put things together, I would never have picked Percy.
I know, me neither. Like, but I really loved that it was him, and I love that Annabeth, you know, not only did we get the spider thing, but, like, Annabeth has her weaknesses, too, and it's architecture games, and that's okay.
I really just would have thought Grover, being the nature spirit that he is, like, I know he kind of got sucked into the game shooting the rednecks, which is hilarious. It's terrible, but also hilarious. Why he got sucked into that game, like, the technology of it all, like, I kind of thought Grover would have been the one to pull them out of something like that. But no, thank goodness, Percy has his skeptical hat on today.
Yeah.
And he kind of notices some clothing choices, whatever, and quickly realizes that there are kids here who think it's 1977, 1985, 1992, and it is none of the above. So yeah. They need to get their butts out of there ASAP. And I love that he, you know, gets Annabeth out of her architecture trance with, what is it? Does he just yell spiders?
I think he does.
Yeah, it's just like, spiders, Annabeth, spiders! And she kind of goes, whoa, you're right.
Snaps out of it.
She's like, you're right. This place is crazy. Like, we gotta go. Like, it's just, yeah, it's delightful.
Yeah. Oh, man, I can't wait to see this on screen. Now I'm just gonna keep saying, I can't wait to see this on screen.
I will say, the Lotus Hotel and Casino is probably one of the highlights. Like, I'm interested to see how Oasis-y they make it feel and look and how they kind of give across that, like, magic feeling. And
I hope that, you know, this is one of the things that in the show they could probably dive a little more into. Like, this could be an entire episode, is like struggling, because a lot happens in this chapter, and I feel like if you want to do an entire episode on this set, you absolutely could, and kind of expand it and like meet some more people and maybe give hints to other things. It's 100% doable.
Like, they're just sucked in and they go up to their room, and then, you know, maybe something happens and Percy's kind of like, huh, that's weird. And they go downstairs and then something else happens. You know, like, it's, I can see an entire episode flashing before my eyes. So, yeah, that is definitely something we're looking forward to. Okay, so that pretty much wraps things up. Let's dive into our favorite quotes. And once again, Karen, do you want to go first?
Yes. This is a conversation between Annabeth and Percy, and it's basically the war that is brewing between, like, Poseidon and Zeus and all the other things that are going on. And Annabeth tells Percy, I don't know what my mom will do. I just know I'll fight next to you. And Percy goes, why? And she says, because you're my friend, Seaweed Brain. Any more stupid questions? And it was just funny and hilarious, but also, like, very kind of a touching moment between the two of them. And for Annabeth to go against her mom, the goddess Athena, is kind of a big deal. And I love that it's just because she knows Percy has nothing to do with this and he's just caught in the middle. And I appreciate her wisdom.
I know. I agree. I'm with you there. Mine is a moment after Grover blesses the zebra and the lion and the antelope and kind of gives them safe passage back to the wild. Percy says, why can't you place a blessing like that on us? And Grover says, it only works on animals. And Annabeth says, so it would only affect Percy. To which Percy goes, hey!
Yeah.
And
I love the banter. I love that they're really becoming friends. And it's just really cool to watch.
Agreed. I'm a sucker for a good witty banter.
Yeah.
Every time. All right, so now we'll do favorite moments. Karen, what was yours?
Mine is Percy thinking he had another learning disability because he could only hear the zebra, not the lion. It was so funny.
Oh, Percy.
Poor Percy.
Percy. It's okay. It's all right. God, I love him. Okay, yes, mine was Percy being the one on guard at the Lotus Casino. I would have, as I said, I would have pegged Grover to be the one who wouldn't fall prey to a shiny hotel lobby, but thank goodness Percy was.
Yeah.
Had his skeptical hat on, as I said more.
Definitely.
Okay.
Hey, this is a decently timed podcast episode.
We're doing all right.
We're doing better. We're
doing better. Better. Not, yeah. Anyway. Okay. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Tumblr, Facebook, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which is which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. Email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com as well if you've got all the thoughts and need a slightly longer place to give them to us. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Also, please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help, and we would love to see your thoughts. So we would appreciate that. Thanks. Leave us questions and comments, plus ideas for content you might want to see. We'd be more than happy to take any and or all of your feedback. Next week, we will be doing our own version of What If. If you've watched the Marvel series, you kind of know what that is, but we're gonna ask some questions and give our answers and see what could have changed in the Percy world. Yeah,
explore some story ideas. And if you guys have any for us that you think would make for interesting discussion, like I think your first example was, what if Percy was a girl instead of a boy? And, you know, stuff like that. Let us know and we can talk it out. I'm actually really excited for this episode. I think it's going to be weird and cool and awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be good fun.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Okay, until next time, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.